Good afternoon. We're going to call the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting to order. It is February 14th at 3:31 p.m. We have a quorum to do business. Senator Egan, Senator Coghill, Senator Giesel, Senator Wilson, myself, Senator Dunleavy. Purpose of today's meeting is to hear two bills, SB 48, Insurance for Dependents of the Ceasefire Police, prime sponsor Senator Coghill, and then we will introduce also SJR 2, Constitutional Amendment Appropriation Limit by the Senate State Affairs Committee. So we're going to start with the first bill, which will be SB 48, Insurance for Dependents of the Ceasefire and Police. And Senator Coghill is the prime sponsor of SB 48. Senator Coghill would like to have his staff come up, and they can introduce themselves to the committee, and we can begin the testimony, introduction of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just give a brief introduction.
Sure, Senator.
We have Jordan Schilling, who is the staff member that is the detail guy for me and my committee. Primarily, this is an answer to a problem that has been in the building for some time, and that is how to get insurance benefits for survivors of police officers and firefighters during those horrible, horrible times when, through no fault of their own, they're somebody is killed in the line of action. So there was a couple of different ways to look at it. What we chose to do was to follow the lead of the administration and try to figure out a way to establish a fund that could be used by the Department of Public Safety to take care of state employees through that funding process. So you'll see in here the rules to how that fund would work and what the qualifications are. Currently, the surviving benefits lose health insurance immediately. Well, that's just not acceptable. I mean, it's just not only do you have a devastating loss in your life, but also you find yourself in this real awkward spot of asking for something that should be naturally just a natural matter of course. So so this legislation is has been a topic of some conversation for the last year. And certainly, I felt the pressure for it, the need for it, and the politics of it, quite frankly, during the campaign season. But I made a commitment that if there's an answer, we should find it. And this is the answer, the solution that we've come up with. It would continue medical insurance coverage for the spouse and dependents, and to give some of the qualification timelines for that. So that's just kind of the sponsor's kind of reasoning for it. And if it's okay with you, I'd like to have Mr. Schilling, if it's okay with you, I think if he just went through a brief review of the sectional, that would pretty much give you the detail of the bill. And at that point, we can answer questions, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Mr. Schilling, please identify yourself for the record, and then you can begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. As the Senator said, this concept is not the PERS approach that the legislature has seen in the past. This is a new approach that was brought to us by the administration. I also wanted to mention that Joan Wilkerson from the Department of Law is in the room. She is, I regard her as the expert in the state on this approach. And if you'd like, Mr. Chairman, I can go through the bill, through the sectional summary that's in the members' packets. The bill only has a few sections. What it does is most of the substance of the bill is contained in section number 1. It creates a new chapter in Title 39. That new chapter establishes the Police Officer and Firefighter Survivors Fund. This is a fund that's established in the general fund for the purpose of paying medical insurance premiums for eligible surviving spouses or eligible dependent children of the police officer or firefighter. And this fund will have two separate accounts. One account is for state employees. The other account is for municipal employees. And those accounts can be found on page 2 of the bill. And as you can see at the very top, the state employee survivor account consists of appropriations that are made into the account by the legislature and also consists of any donations that might be made into the account. The municipal account also consists of those two things, appropriations and donations, but also consists of municipal contributions. What this bill does is this bill allows municipalities that have law enforcement agencies to opt in to this fund in order to provide this benefit for the dependent spouse and dependent children of those municipal law enforcement officers. This money does not lapse. Once it is appropriated to the fund, it may be spent for the purposes of paying this benefit without further appropriation. And, of course, nothing in this section creates a dedicated fund. The next part of the bill, section 3960.020, simply says that the commissioner each year, and when we say the commissioner all throughout the bill, we're talking about the commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. The commissioner shall determine the amount of benefit that needs to be paid for that year. The next section of the bill, 3960.030, simply authorizes this payment, these payments to be made. The next section of the bill, 3960.040, is where all of the eligibility language is contained. So there's four criteria that must all be true in order for the dependent spouse or dependent children to be eligible for the benefit. So starting at the bottom of page 2, a person who is a surviving dependent of an employee who is a police officer or firefighter is eligible for premium payments if, and now I'll describe the four factors. First, at the time of death, the employee was a year-round, permanent, full-time employee of the state or a municipality that has opted into this fund. Next, at the time of death, the surviving dependent was receiving the deceased's employer-sponsored medical insurance benefits. Three, the proximate cause of the employee's death is a bodily injury sustained or a hazard undergone while in the performance and within the scope of the employee's duties. The commissioner makes the ultimate determination if the proximate cause was a result of bodily injury sustained or a hazard undergone while working in that job. The fourth criteria is the injury or hazard is not the result of willful negligence. And so, if eligible under those circumstances, the surviving spouse can then become ineligible if the surviving spouse becomes eligible for other major medical insurance coverage or reaches the age of 65, whichever comes first. The dependent child who is determined eligible similarly becomes ineligible if they were to become eligible to receive major medical insurance through other means or reaches the age of 26, whichever comes first. The next section, Mr. Chairman, is the section that allows municipalities to opt in to this fund, 3960.050. It's purely optional, and if a municipality does choose to participate, they come to an agreement with the commissioner. The agreement would stipulate things like the frequency of the payments, the size of the payments, and other sort of rules about how this agreement is going to work. And that is essentially the bill, Mr. Chairman. I want to point the committee to the definitions section. That's 3960.190. It starts on page 4. Child means a biological child, adopted child, or stepchild of an employee. Again, like I said, the word commissioner and department used throughout is referring to the Department of Public Safety. Definition of firefighter means an employee of the state or a municipality employed to perform fire response services. The definition for police officer can be found in Title 18. I'm happy to read it to the committee if you'd like, Mr. Chairman. It's the definition for police officer found in the Police Standards Council statutes.
It's up to the committee. You wish you don't need the definition? Okay.
Not at this point, Mr. Chairman, but I think that's something that we'll probably need to look at eventually as we go through.
Well, if you have it in front of you, go ahead and go through it then.
Sure. So again, this is 1865-290, and I'll summarize a little bit. A police officer means A, an employee of the state or a municipality that has the authority to arrest, has the authority to detain, has the authority to bring someone in front of a judge, things that we generally consider police powers. The definition also includes officers or employees of the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities who are stationed at an international airport and has been designated to have general police powers. And then finally, a University of Alaska public safety officer with general police powers. So, Mr. Chairman, almost done here. Section 2, we're now to Section 2. It simply says that the Department of Public Safety shall work in cooperation with the Department of Administration to administer this fund. Sections 3, 4, and 5 establish the effective dates. This bill becomes effective on July 1st. However, there is a provision that allows the department to begin adopting regulations immediately upon passage, so that when the effective date does roll around July 1st, the regulations will be adopted and in place.
Is that your testimony?
Yes, ma'am.
Questions from members of the committee? Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Municipal benefits. A lot of municipalities around Alaska have a lot of volunteer firefighters. If the municipal government, if they chose to put money into the fund to fund volunteer firefighters, is that a possibility or to be included in this?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I think the answer could be found when you look at the definition of firefighter and police officer. And under the bill as written now, if the individual that you're referring to is an employee of the state or is an employee of a municipality that has chosen to opt in, and they are eligible under the other provisions of the bill, then yes, my guess is they would be eligible for a benefit.
And just as a follow-up, it said they would have to be, the firefighter would have to be eligible, and page 4, line 15, at the time of death, a firefighter was eligible to receive an employee-sponsored medical insurance, and since they're volunteers, they would not receive that benefit.
And through the chair, Senator Wilson, are these volunteers that you're referring to, are they employees of that municipality?
I'm not sure for every municipality going forth, but they don't currently receive this full benefits of their full-time counterparts. And so they're just volunteers that get a call to respond to the fire. So they're not real, they're volunteer employees. They're not on the books. They don't receive PERS and TERS benefits.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the bill as designed is for state and municipal employees that are full-time, permanent, year-round employees. We do, again, have Joan Wilkerson from the Department of Law that might be able to address the volunteer question. But the bill as written is for full-time, paid, year-round, permanent employees who work for the municipality or state.
Senator?
I guess as a comment that, you know, our volunteer firefighters in the state risk their lives just as much as the next paid employee to respond to fires. And at this time where we have a lot of firefighters who or employers that don't allow them to leave their jobs to respond to fires, it's just another risk and duty that may add to sort of adverse relationships to not wanting to respond to fires or to be involved in a firefighter if I don't have knowing that my family won't be covered if I do my best to cover a response to these type of emergencies. So just something maybe to consider as we look forward to this bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carlico.
What we can do is we can do a little bit of searching to find out what is available now to volunteers and find out how a municipality might look at that, because chances are, I know of in my neck of the woods, we depend upon the firefighters who are volunteer for a lot of good reasons. So we'll do a little bit of search and maybe get back to the chairman with what is already available to them and what kind of a relationship would have to be built in order for them to be under this coverage.
I'm making an assumption that if you go by the strict definition, employee means you're employed, you get paid for it, and a municipality means it's a municipality. We have fire service areas all over the state that are not in municipalities that have volunteer firemen. I would imagine the way this is written, they would not qualify under this law as employees and or employed by a municipality.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Can you give us a history? One of the things I think that interests me is this issue. I'm not going to say it's just coming up. It's been around for, I've heard of it for several years, but what has been the practice in statehood when an individual police officer, trooper, firefighter dies in the line of service? What has happened? Did something happen that has caused a diminishment of benefits? I'm just trying to understand why this is an issue now as opposed to something that happened in the early 60s that got worked out.
Mr. Chairman, again, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. In the members' packets, there is a brief description of the benefits that peace officers receive if killed in the line of duty that their dependent family receives, I mean. And so I know that there is currently a benefit provided, but not for medical insurance premiums, which is what this bill envisions. I would imagine, although I'm opining a little bit, that the reason that this has been brought to the surface more recently is just because we have had some recent deaths. But it may be better for Department of Law to speak to the many iterations of this concept over the past few years.
I'd like to ask. I'm just trying to find out why this is an issue now. I mean, don't get me wrong. I understand that there are deceased police officers and they have families. But why that issue hadn't been worked out decades ago? Why is it something that's happening right now?
That's fair.
And who would we speak to about that?
Mr. Chair, I might recommend Joan Wilkerson from the Department of Law. She's here in the room.
Ms. Wilkerson, could you come forward and identify yourself for the record? If you could answer that, that would be helpful.
My name is Joan Wilkerson. I'm Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. Mr. Chair, to specifically try to describe the history of the state's provision of benefits to police and firefighters who've been killed in the line of duty would go back quite a ways. The PERS system was originally surrounded that group of people, and it actually expanded to other employees over time. But to bring your question back to simply the provision of survivor health benefits, it's my understanding that that has not been afforded before.
Ever.
And to my knowledge, no. And while it is available to the families of Tier 1 employees automatically, it's not available to Tier 2 or Tier 3 or our defined contribution members either. So
if it's available to Tier 1, entry into Tier 1 ended, I'm trying to remember the year it ended, was it 88? I think it was in the 80s, mid to late 80s. So those folks up until that point would have been covered, so that's why that may not have been an issue. But still, you have the late 80s till now. Could it have been that there have been some families of deceased officers and firefighters that just never claimed or never pursued the benefit?
There could be. We have generated some data on that issue to try to answer that question, and we have some tables available. In most cases, there have been benefits available. When the spouse of the deceased employee reaches retirement age, they are able to access major medical through their retiree health plan. And a lot of times there are other benefits available, but health benefits, there's apparently a void that needs to be filled, so that's why we're focusing on it.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Wilkerson? Mr. Shilley, can you just walk us through the mechanics one more time on how this fund is funded, where the funds come from, and how it's funded, please?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Again, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. We can find that on page 2 of the bill at the top. And this fund has two separate accounts. One is for the purpose of paying benefits to state employee survivors. The other is to pay benefits to municipal employee survivors. Appropriations can be made into both accounts by the legislature. And also donations can be made into both accounts. The unique one is under the municipal employee survivor account, where municipalities, if opted in, can contribute money into that account for the purposes of paying the benefit to eligible dependents.
So the language says you may, or at least the municipality or the state may appropriate. That's not a compulsion. They don't have to appropriate.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The use of may is pervasive throughout the bill, and I believe that is to ensure that we're not doing anything that creates a dedicated fund. At the end of the day, too, Mr. Chairman, this money can always be reappropriated by a future legislature.
And tell us the estimated amount that would be the startup for this fund, or that's what you're anticipating?
Mr. Chairman, we just got a new fiscal note about 5 minutes before the hearing. I would guess, I'm venturing it's about $70,000 for three dependent families currently.
Refinies. Recess. Mr. Schilling, could you talk to us once again about the fund and the budget amount, initial budget amount that we're looking at?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Again, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. This fiscal note reflects $70,116 total. That is split amongst three dependent surviving families, which comes out to a total of $23,372 per family.
And so would the fund be, the fund would be, would exist, and if unfortunately there were other dependents because of tragedies that occur in the line of duty, would the fund just get an interjection of new funding to account for those new folks that would be coming in because of the tragedy?
That's a good question, Mr. Chairman. You know, sure, Senator Coghill.
Could answer that.
Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, the commissioner has to make an annual look at this and adjust it for an annual appropriation. And what you hit upon is one of the reasons why we're going to the fund approach rather than to an actuarial, because in Alaska it would be so dramatic a shift with one life change, one family change. It would be so dramatic that having an appropriation that could pay the premium from that fund was important. So this would be leaning really on recommendations from the commissioner, I think.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could add, it's my understanding that the way this fund works is that the legislature could put in additional money than what was necessary for that fiscal year. In other words, kind of front load the fund in order to accommodate for an untimely death following the fiscal year ending or something like that. So because the money isn't automatically swept, and it does not lapse and rolls over, and because the legislature doesn't have to take any additional action for the commissioner to use that money after the initial appropriation, I believe that it could be kind of flexible and that it could be front-loaded to accommodate for that.
So would this fund be managed and handled out of the commissioner's office or out of Department of Revenue, or how would this be managed?
And Mr. Chairman, the bill has the Department of Public Safety's commissioner managing the fund, but doing so in cooperation with the Department of Administration.
Questions for members of the committee? Senator Wilson?
A fund similar to this, would it be something like the VCCB, the Victim Crime Compensation Board, to get together to help make sure the fund is managed correctly, that payouts are managed correctly? Have you guys looked at another way to sort of manage this fund with a little bit more oversight than just sort of one individual?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, that's something that the sponsor's office has talked about. Of course, this committee, being a policymaking body, can create additional oversight, and I have not been following the discussions in the other body on their bill and how it's become divergent from this one, but it's certainly possible to add more oversight. Happy to talk to you afterwards about that.
And just an additional question.
Yes.
In the police definition, does this also cover village safety police peace officers?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, it does not. They are not employees of the state. And under the definition of peace officer in our PERS program, VPSOs are also not covered. They have not been covered in previous iterations of this bill as well.
Thank you.
Questions for members of the committee? I have a question. So this is an issue that's come up last year, obviously, and there's been much discussion. There have been bills written. Why do you feel this approach is the way to go? I mean, I've heard of many different approaches. Life insurance policy that could be substantial. Different approaches. Tell us again why you believe that this approach is the way to solve this.
Mr. Chairman, you know, this approach, and maybe Senator Coghill can speak to this, this approach originated from one of the administration's working groups over the interim. There are some issues with past approaches that amended the PERS program. There's a document in the members' packet that lays out seven reasons why the PERS approach was problematic. This approach, on a case-by-case, as-needed approach, allows for more flexibility, allows the legislature to have a little bit more control, and certainly provides more flexibility to the municipalities who have the option of opting in. But it might be best for the administration to speak to some of the policy calls that were made in the working group.
Senator Coghill.
If I could just add to that, this is a premium payment method. And so what we're trying to do is not be the insurer, but get them insurance as quickly as we can. And I think the flexibility, both at the fund, at the commissioner level, is to get as immediate action as we can. Because I think one of the saddest things that we found out during the last couple of tragedies was that the as soon as the death had been certified, the insurance stopped. And that's why you need a little flexibility at the commissioner's office to get that premium in as soon as practical. So we give 30 days, but this allows action to happen immediately, and then the paperwork can follow those 30 days. So it's a premium payment methodology that is probably better than us managing the whole insurance. I think that's just a better methodology. It's more nimble, but it also means you have to go through an annual appropriation.
Mm-hmm. And that annual appropriation, once again, could vary depending upon, again, the unfortunate situation of having families having to be in need of insurance. And that fund could, the appropriation could rise and fall depending upon the number of dependents in a particular family as well, correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
Are there others prepared to testify today on the bill? Okay. Any questions, further questions? Excuse me? Okay, brief at ease. So right now we don't have a notice for public testimony, so we're going to have to put it off to the side, and we will notice it for public testimony at our next meeting. Will there be others that you would want to hear as invited testimony as well from the Department of Administration, Public Safety, et cetera?
I think I'll probably ask the Public Safety to come and testify. At this point, I just wanted to lay the mechanics out in front of you and make sure that you understood, and then maybe be able to compare what other iterations in the building are happening, so that at least you could see the mechanics and do an honest comparison. So at this point, I think it's a fairly clean bill, but I even noticed a couple of places in there where we could probably change some things to make it better.
Any additional questions for members of the committee before we put it off to the side, and then we'll bring it back at a later date and open it up for public testimony, invited testimony? Seeing none, we'll put this off to the side, and we'll pick it up again. We're going to take a brief at ease to get ready for the next bill. actually a revision. This is SJR 2, so if you want to turn into your book, and we'll get to that section. So we're going to go back online here. Back in session. So next we're going to turn to an introduction of a joint resolution, SJR 2. It's a constitutional amendment appropriation limit. This SJR 2 is sponsored by the Senate State Affairs Committee. I'll ask my staff, Daniel George, to come forward, state his name for the record, and present the resolution. And we'll have an opportunity to ask some questions after he goes through this. So, Mr. George, please state your name for the record, and let's begin.
Good afternoon, members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. For the record, my name is Daniel George, staff to Senator Mike Dunleavy, Chair. Before members, the Senate Joint Resolution 2. The bill at one page, front and back, contains quite a bit. It is not...
It does, and let me just interrupt you for a second. Daniel. Let me just give you a 30,000-foot overview, and then we'll have Daniel get into the particulars. So we have in our Constitution, as we speak, a constitutional appropriation limit that went to the people in 81 and was voted on and went on the books in 82, was reaffirmed in 86, and this appropriation limit came during a time, probably a 10 to 15-year period, when Alaska was coming into a lot of oil money, and there was concern that we were spending it. What came into existence about the same time was the permanent fund, the appropriation limit, the PFD, and then later on the constitutional reserve. All of these tools were put in place by the people of Alaska and their legislature in an attempt, once again, to act as a brake on spending and to preserve some of the money for future generations. This appropriation limit, as all bills do, go through a committee process, and as a result, many of us feel that it never really worked the way it was designed because the baseline that it started out with, in other words, the trajectory of spend was steep, and then the different components of the resolution were such that they were very generous. Some would say there were holes. They ended up being holes within the appropriation limit itself. So the long story short is, we would have to be spending about close to $10 billion, neighborhood of $10 billion UGF, unrestricted general fund, to hit the ceiling on this limit. That was for a time, again, when there was lots of money, there was a steep trajectory in the spend. Folks were concerned they wanted to preserve money for future generations of Alaskans. Our reality today is a little different. We don't have the money to fund the size of government that we have. And so many of us have been talking about what are some ways that we can constrain the growth of government and come, you know, as you've heard the term, right-sized government, size of government, et cetera, but how do we maneuver or position Alaska as we look into the future to have a size of government that takes care of our basic needs, our constitutional needs, takes care of our schools, our roads, our emergency services, our police, et cetera, without having just an open checkbook concept that we've had for quite some time. This will bring down the baseline spend. This will fill in some of the, plug some of the holes, some of the components that were very generous. And it will box us into a bit of a tighter constraint as we move forward. So that's kind of the general background, and Daniel's going to go through, Mr. George is going to go through the various components of it and give you a more detailed look as to what is trying to be accomplished here. And then once again, we'll go back and be able to ask some questions. But there's no doubt that this resolution is going to be an important tool for Alaska going into the future. And we want to do this right. And as many of us have been having conversations about this, we want to make this a simple resolution, but one that's very effective. And hopefully that whatever gets through the process and we would go on the general election next year, general election ballot next year, will be a tool that will help Alaska as we maneuver towards the future. So with that, Mr. George, I'm sorry for interrupting you, but if you can continue, that'd be great.
Certainly, Senator, and please feel free to interject during this presentation. It's built to stir these kinds of conversations. So Senate Joint Resolution 2 is a timely conversation. It addresses a clause in our Constitution that for some time has not been relevant to the discussion. But given our current predicament, it is an option to help us deal with our fiscal situation as well as guide the state going forward. And it's an opportunity to respect the intent of the voters who enshrined this in the Constitution, not once but twice. The way Joint Resolution 2 functions is it takes all state spending and it places it within a dollar cap limit. And that is the way the existing Article 9, Section 16 reads. And then it names and lists out the items that are outside of that limit. What you have before you is a bill that is a repeal and reenact to read. And I know that that is sometimes difficult for folks in the public and members to catch the nuances of what has taken place here. So in members' packets, they will find a document. It looks like this here. It's two pages. I apologize that it may be in black and white. It's supposed to be colorized, but we'll post it in color. And it places side by side the language in the existing Constitution, and I believe members should have a copy of the Constitution for them on their desk, side by side with the corresponding clause in the bill. The existing language is presented in order as it reads verbatim in the Constitution, and it is placed side by side with a clause that may be out of order, but it's from the bill, so you can see how it corresponds and see if there's any changes that have been made. You will also see that there is a staff commentary column. As we get through the presentation here, we'll talk about the genesis and how this bill came to be. It is the product of some work during the interim and legislative finance recommendations, work with Legal Services Division. Also, we reached out to former legislators, staff from former governors, including the Governor Hammond's administration. This was originally a Governor Hammond bill. So we wanted to get some context and make sure that when we go back and revisit this, that we don't do a disservice to the original intent. So the way Senate Joint Resolution 2 works is it takes all state spending and places it within a limit and then lists each item which is exempt from the limit. And as Senator Dunleavy pointed out, it would be on the ballot in November of 2018. At this point, I'm going to go through the presentation because we'll kind of talk about the different items. Switching to slide 2, for some of the public who may not be familiar with this concept, as it's not often talked about, folks refer to a lot of things in the Constitution. This isn't typically one you hear in conversation. The appropriation limit, Article 9, Section 16, is an annual cap on the appropriations. It adjusts annually based on the formula. It's the cumulative change in population and inflation. That's 100% of the cumulative change of both of those indices. And that has been calculated annually, which is how we are able to get the limit, which is just over $10 billion today. And there's a slide coming up which will show what that limit is done over time. And then, of course, I have the definition here from the Office of Management and Budget, which defines appropriation. And you will hear the terms appropriation limit and spending limit used interchangeably, and to some degree that can be done. Just note that appropriation is authorization to spend, and what you actually spend may be less than what you authorize. So that is the distinction between the two. Going to slide 3. How many states have spending limits or appropriation limits? According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, 30 states operate under these, and these are in part of a broader category called tax and expenditure limits, or TELs. And Alaska's has been in the Constitution since 1982. Some states have both spending limits and tax limits. Some states have limits on how taxes can be increased or even levied. Some states, like Colorado, limit it all the way down to the local level. Alaska's appropriation limit is a state appropriation limit. It does not apply to municipalities or local governments.
Can I interject?
Yes.
And you have many, many municipalities, including municipalities in Alaska, that have opted for certain caps. For example, Anchorage has a tax cap, and other municipalities you would have to go to actually get a vote of the people to raise a tax or employ some other revenue measure. But you'll oftentimes hear an appropriation limit used in the same breath as a revenue limit. They're slightly different, but the effects are, they're trying to have the same effect, and that's limit the growth and size of government. Please continue.
Thank you, Senator. So 23 states have a spending limit. Of the states that have tax expenditure limits, roughly half of those are constitutional in nature and the other half are statutory. Alaska has both, as you may know. The constitutional limit, 1982, and then the statutory limit was enacted by the legislature in 1986, the same year that the constitutional limit was up for a revisit. When the bill passed the legislature and went to the voters, it was known that they would revisit the limit in 4 years. So they knew it would be on the ballot again in 4 years, and they had a chance to look at it and see how it was doing and see if it's something they liked or not. The legislature passed the statutory limit, knowing that full well the constitutional limit may or may not exist later on, but the statutory limit would exist regardless.
But it's important to, once again, just emphasize that this is not something new for the people of Alaska. They had a say on this decades ago, and they did want an appropriation limit, an expenditure limit, and they did want to constrain the legislature and the size of government. So, again, this is not something brand new. This is going to be a revision to the existing amendment.
Continuing on, slide four. So how did we get our limit? I think we talked a little bit about this. Historical context, Alaska's budgets have grown in quick bursts over the years. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline was completed and first oil came out in June of 1976. The permanent fund was established later that year. And you'll see a spending graph there. It's from the Legislative Finance Division. It's available on their website, and the source is cited there if anyone wants to see the full presentation. It shows how the state's total budget tripled from the FY79 to 82. So in a three-year period, and this is excluding fund transfers like the $1.8 billion appropriation to the permanent fund in FY82, which makes this graph look a little more stark. For reference, so you see the 1982 budget was $3.2 billion. For reference, in non-adjusted dollars, the FY06 budget was $3.29 billion. It was 14 years later. So Alaska was facing a challenge of plenty at the time, and there was a robust dialogue about the need for an appropriation limit that took place in the early 80s, and this is actually the cover page of a document that our office has and would be happy to share with folks if they want to know what Alaska's leaders were talking about when this discussion was taking place. There's pieces from former governors. Our current lieutenant governor even has a piece that's in there with their thoughts on it back then. So as a backup document, we will make that available to any member who wishes. Senator?
Senator Cockfield.
Sure. This is a good graph, but in the Constitution, we talk about inflation rate. And so is this in real dollars or is this inflated dollars?
Through the Chair, Senator Cockfield, this is in nominal dollars. These are not adjusted. So if you were to turn this into real dollars, you see that blip around the early 80s. It would look nearly as high as the top of the chart on the right-hand side there in the 2000s. So what they were facing was, and if you look at it in terms of real per capita, it's very significant. There's a whole presentation of about 10 slides that Legislative Finance has put together on this. You may or may not be familiar with it. That link at the bottom of the picture is to that presentation. And I think I probably should include that with the packet for members so they can actually see how this, when you look at it in various real versus nominal dollars. But yes, to answer your question, this is in nominal dollars, not adjusted.
I think that's just a context that we need to kind of keep in front of us because we're going to be asking them to think about how it would look in the adjusted dollars along the way. And yet, it just shows that stark reality of the huge volume of dollars that have come and gone.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Slide five. How did we get our limit further? So legislature passed a Senate Joint Resolution 4, which is a bill that existed in the 1981 session. You may have heard that Alaska had a coup at one time, and that took place in that session. And then the governor, after receiving the budget from the legislature, I've been told by many folks who were on staff and around at the time, thought the budget was perhaps a little larger than he would have liked. And he wanted some fiscal guarantee for the future for the state and requested that, called a three-day special session in July of 1981 before signing the budget, asking for this limit to go before the legislature. And so that's how we got the bill passed. It's my understanding, according to the legislative records I've been able to find. And then it went to the voters in 1982. There is a document in the backup. It's a one-page New York Times article from 1981. I did note that some members actually campaigned against the limit's adoption at the time. The limit passed when it was put before the voters the following year with 61% of the vote. And then 4 years later, it passed again with 71% of the vote. So it only grew in its popularity over time.
It's just something to imagine. When you look at that chart, you can see that each time each time the people of Alaska had an opportunity to vote on this and to reaffirm it, they did it by larger numbers. And imagine for a moment if the baseline spend and the formula was actually more constrained and less of an incline, you'd probably have billions upon billions more dollars in our savings accounts as we speak. And this issue that we've been grappling with for the last 2 or 3 years would not be as large as it is today. And so this is what we're trying to do. It's learn from the past, and it's learn from what is going on right now, so that when we chart this course for the future and future Alaskans, that we put it on a course for a much more fiscally sustainable future.
Thank you, Senator. So this gets us to the point of, so why all this in background information? Why is this so important? You know, it gets us to why we're here today. In slide 6, you'll see the actual calculation annually of the appropriation limit as it applies to the state's expenditures, and then the gold lines are actual expenditures, the ones that qualify under the limit. This is calculated by the Legislative Finance Division. You'll see that we got within about $200 to $300 million of it in one, perhaps 2 years. I note that the limit was effective for FY84 onward, but you'll see that the limit will continue to increase as long as population and inflation don't either cancel each other out or go negative, while state expenditures will have to do quite a dramatic increase to even make it relevant again. That limit will continue to go up as long as Alaska grows where inflation occurs. Oh, what happened here? We have technical difficulty for the members of the public here. You have brief at ease, Mr. Chairman?
Brief at ease. We're back in session. Please continue, Mr. George.
Yeah, so this graph, just simply to the point of this graph, is that we are currently at half of the appropriation limit. And that's basically it. So the next slide, 7, I would like to express my gratitude to the Legislative Library for their work, as well as Legislative Finance Division and Legal Services attorneys, and Mr. Gardner and his staff over there for working with us to come to this point. And during the interim, Senator Dunleavy requested that Legislative Finance look at the limits we have in statute and the Constitution, and they came back with some recommendations for if we were to revisit them and make them applicable, ways we could close loopholes, fix what may be perceived by some as flaws, and make it a meaningful limit again. And so we took those recommendations, we studied them, we did research, and we started crafting a bill. We went through many iterations. It's not to claim that we're at a perfect product at this point. There's a committee process. This bill has three committees to go through in the Senate before it goes to the other body, if it gets there, and we hope it does. So I just want to point out this is a process that we've been working with others on. And a couple key elements of the bill. It has to be simple enough that you can explain it in a community council meeting and folks are going to understand it, but it has to be comprehensive enough that it's going to work for budget and policymakers, so that it captures the nuances of state spending. One word difference can mean hundreds of millions of dollars in this limit, for depending on how you craft it, and I'll touch on a few of those here in a minute. On the right-hand side, there's a picture of a document that's in the backup to members' packets. It's prepared by the Office of Management and Budget when the limit went back on the ballot in 86. And OMB compiled this with historical information, talked about how the limit is calculated, how various funds apply and do not apply. It's a good primer on the limit itself as we have it in the Constitution. And I believe it is of some value if members really want to delve into this. Let's see here. Yeah, it's complex because it has to be in some regards. That's what it comes down to. So in order to be on the 2018 ballot, it just has to pass in the 30th legislature before the election. I pulled the statute here from Division of Elections. If it doesn't make it, doesn't pass in time when they print the ballots, then they have to print a separate ballot, is the answer to a question I often get. What's the cutoff date? So that's the plain language of the statute there, you see.
And this is a, once again, we're going through a time where we may be asking the people of Alaska for the first time in decades to contemplate, quote, a tax, contemplate some reconfiguration of the permanent fund. And the feedback I've been getting from constituents is all they want to pull together and help Alaska get through this period of time. But they're very concerned about once we get through this period of time, is it going to be an open checkbook? And is it going to be their checkbook that's open for any future increases in taxes, any future reconfigurations of the permanent fund? And the feedback that I get from constituents is they want to keep government constrained and as small as possible so that they can keep as much money in their pockets. I haven't had a discussion with any constituents that do not believe that we should be sure that we have adequate public safety, good roads, good schools. Their concern is some of the other things that we may have spent our money on in the past. They would like us not to go back to that spending, where when we get money, we spend it for the most part. We save a little bit, but we spend it for the most part. They want to be able to be assured that as we move forward, they're going to be able to retain as much money in their pockets, and the state will have adequate funds to deliver basic services.
So continuing on here, I guess it's important to point out in the bill that it would go before voters in the fall of 2018, which is during fiscal year 19, and if passed, would become effective 30 days after certification of the election, unless there is a date that the legislature chooses to make this bill effective. Then that's when it would become effective. But if it passes in 2018, it would apply to the FY 2020 budget. So the items that are exempt from the appropriation limit, these are the items that are considered outside. Appropriations to the Alaska Permanent Fund, and a lot of these mirror the existing items, for payments of permanent fund dividends, that is currently outside the limit as well. These are appropriations in the budget. Appropriations to meet a state of disaster declared by the governor is prescribed by law, and I've inserted the statute here in the presentation. The statutory references are not appropriate inside of a bill going into the Constitution because statutes can be renumbered by the legislature at any time. Appropriations of state general obligation or revenue bond proceeds. Obligations required to pay obligations under state GO bonds or revenue bonds. Those are, general obligation bonds go before the voters of the state, and this is a policy call. If the voters have approved it at that point, then it has been approved statewide.
And revenue bonds have revenue attached to service those bonds is the idea behind a revenue bond.
That's correct. And these are obligations under those. Appropriations of money received from the federal government. We spell that out a little bit here. Actually, let me pull up the language here. Appropriations of the federal government, yes. The way the original wording read, I think it was something to the effect of money held in trust for another purpose. And so that has been interpreted historically to mean from the federal government. We just clarify that. The intent of this SJR2 is to simplify it whenever possible. Number 8 is a little bit wonky. The intent here is to try and capture duplicate appropriations, spending with, two different agencies having the same money in their budget. They're passing it from one to another, so you don't count that kind of spending. Of money held in trust by the state for a particular purpose, talking about Exxon Valley's oil spill, mental health trust, and so on. Money received by the state from a source other than the state or federal government that is restricted to it. So if you had a grant, if you received, say Apple wanted to give every kid in your school a laptop or something like that, that would be a one-time item that you wouldn't necessarily, if you spent that money to buy those laptops, that wouldn't count against your limit. A revenue of a public enterprise or public corporation that issues revenue bonds. And we actually had a legal services opinion on this one that came out after we introduced the bill. The university, legal services does believe qualifies under this, and so we will have to address that in this committee. And then appropriations of money deposited into the CBR back to the accounts from where it came. This is the reverse sweep that occurs annually. The state has about a $13.2 billion obligation to the Constitutional Budget Reserve, so when there is money left over at the end of the year or in funds, it is automatically swept into the CBR unless it is reverse swept. Finally, to a state savings account or fund as prescribed by law, that would have to be clarified in some kind of a statutory companion. because we don't want to make a statutory reference in the Constitution again. At this point, this could be the CBR, the SBR, whatever else the legislature appropriately deems a state savings account. And then finally, of dedicated funds, there's about $80 to $82 million, and there are two documents in the packet for members. One is a list of all the dedicated funds and the values that they are in the FY18 budget, and then there's another document that lists all of the fund codes that fall subject to this limit and the total amount of spending in FY16, 17, and 18 under this proposed bill. So I just note for the public and for members that that is on basis and available to members. This is another way of looking at it. This is this slide here tries to capture that there are different types of spending and how they are treated under the existing limit and the new limit. I will note that one significant item which was not spelled out in the original limit was municipal debt service. We're talking about there's transportation infrastructure bonds that are on a local level, and there's also oftentimes school debt reimbursement. And those are approved on a municipal-wide basis, and the state, under a statute that dates back to 1971, has made an annual appropriation, not every year, as we know, but in most years, to offset or pay the municipalities for those costs. As a policy call, the way the SJR2 works is it takes all state spending, except for the items in the exclusions, and puts them on equal footing with one another, so that they compete for scarce resources on equal footing. And so this bill would take municipal debt reimbursement and place it within the limit. That doesn't mean it wouldn't be paid, that just they would have to compete with other items. We'll move on further here. And so the other major portion of the limit, besides the dollar cap and what's inside or outside, is the trajectory of the limit, the growth formula. So under the existing Article 9, Section 16, it's 100% of the cumulative change in population and inflation. This here shows a middle line there that kind of cuts off that mountain of spending in the last, FY06 to maybe 13, 14, 15. This is if we had gone back in time and changed that provision to read 50%. So 50% of the population plus 50% of inflation. And you'll see that it doesn't just take off the top 1,000 foot of Mount Everest, but it also doesn't come into play until about FY06. There is a tool that our office has been given by the Legislative Finance Division. It's a sort of a calculator tool that allows you to put various values into population and inflation for the limit historically and see where that line would have fallen. You could make it parallel the existing or be much lower if you wanted to, and that's something I can make available to members and their staff if they're interested in looking at that. But in the draft, in the bill that is before members today, it's 50% of population, 50% of inflation, and that's what it would have looked like historically.
So looking at that graph, you've got three lines. You have it looks like a dark blue, a lighter blue, and a gold or yellow. If this was in place as being presented today, those spikes later on, about 06 and on, would not have occurred.
Yes, thank you, Senator, for the opportunity to clarify that. It's the spending between the two lines, so the gold that's between the two blue lines is the spending that would have been capped or constrained or not been allowed to happen.
And it would fall under the lighter blue line, is that correct?
Correct.
So that represents billions of dollars that would have been put into savings that we would have today. And that's one of the major points of trying to revise this, is we will come into more revenue over time. We know about the fines that are occurring on the slope as we speak. We know that oil most likely will rebound. We don't know to what degree, but the point being, if we're prepared for that future, we have an opportunity to save more of that money going into the future with this appropriation limit being revised.
And finally, I'll just leave members and the committee with, there's a few items we flagged for future consideration as we go through this process. There is about $7.4 million in unrestricted federal funds that the state actually receives, as Legislative Finance Division informed me. And I do have Rob Carpenter from Legislative Finance Division here with me if there are technical questions or questions about what funding falls where. He is available for the committee today. I also have online Megan Wallace with Legal Services Division if there are questions about the function of the bill. And for the policy considerations, we talked about university receipts, appropriations to a state savings account that would need to be clarified in state law and statute. As a policy call, dedicated funds have been excluded from the limit. And then the capital budget is within the limit, except for general obligation bonds or funds that are listed out in the exclusions. And then if there's a need for a pressure relief valve, is the term I've heard used for it, a way if you had to do spending outside the limit in an emergency situation. There have been other states that have provisions like this. However, they have been abused, I think is a fair way to characterize it. Some states simply declare an emergency every year, and that's how they get around the limit. Or they have simply declared, okay, retirement assistance is now outside the limit. We just say so. And so those are important things to keep in mind when talking about overriding the limit. So with that, if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer those.
Any questions for Mr. George at this point? This is a bill that we're going to really take our time and do it right, because once again, changing something in the bill or adding something really needs to be scrutinized and evaluated to see if it stays within our parameters of being simple and effective. What we don't want to do is end up where the folks in 82 ended up, and that was they wanted a spending limit. It went through the process, as we know how the process can be with bills, with amendments and changes, and what came out the other end was a spending limit. And if the trajectory of spend kept at that trajectory, that baseline, it probably would have constrained us, but the reality was we would have to spend about $10 billion. And we have a new reality going forward. And so we're going to be open to ideas and suggestions. We're going to have, a pretty long and good debate with making this the best possible spending limit in the country, appropriation limit in the country. And so even if we passed it this year, it would not go on the ballot to win, Mr. George.
November of 2018.
Right. So we have some time to do this right. I want to thank Rob Carpenter and others in Ledge Finance. We worked extensively with them here in the fall before the session, and I just was very impressed with your work and the work of your colleagues. So I just want to put that on the record. Very impressed. And the ideas that came from Megan as well and others have really put together a very, very good starting point in terms of a potential amendment to the constitutional amendment we have on the books right now. We have two other folks online that I'd like to be able to give an opportunity to speak on this Senate joint resolution. And Rob and others, we're probably going to bring you back, and we will have questions. We're going to be hearing this bill several more times, and we'll have, I think, more detailed questions to ask. But for now, we're going to switch to folks online, let them speak on the bill, and then if there's any questions, we'll come back here into Juneau, and if there's questions for Rob or others, we'll ask those questions. But online right now, we have Jeremy Price with Americans for Prosperity. Mr. Price, are you online?
Good to be with you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. Could you please state your name for the record and begin your testimony?
Yes, sir. My name is Jeremy Price. I'm the Alaska State Director of Americans for Prosperity. By way of introduction, I'm a third-generation Alaskan from Salter, Alaska. I spent 9 years working on Alaska's federal issues in Washington. While there, I handled federal appropriations for Congressman Young and Senator Murkowski. Americans for Prosperity is a grassroots organization that advocates for everyday Alaskans and small businesses who don't have a registered lobbyist there in Juneau. We feel that it is essential that regular Alaskans have a voice in public policy matters, especially since Juneau is such a logistically challenging and expensive destination. We opened the Alaska chapter of Americans for Prosperity in the summer of 2014. Now, to examine this issue, we have to consider the problems associated with the existing state spending limit or appropriation limit in our Constitution. As has been noted previously, the existing cap of $2.5 billion in 1982, adjusting for inflation and population growth, would equal just over $10 billion today. Alaska has come close on two occasions to hitting the appropriation limit, once in fiscal year 09 and once in fiscal year 13. The fact that the spending limit was almost reached on two occasions is alarming in and of itself because it is so high. Spending increased dramatically from 2004 to 2014, in fact, more than double in size. In FY04, agency operations, statewide operations, and the capital budget totaled just above $3 billion. But by 2009, state spending had exploded to $7.4 billion and $8.7 billion in FY13. I'd like to pause for a moment, Mr. Chairman, and make sure we consider the recent history of state spending. That was $3 billion in 2004, and by 2013, it was $8.7 billion. There were roughly 737,000 residents of Alaska in 2013, so the legislature was spending roughly $11,800 for every Alaskan that year. Decades of history point to one overwhelming conclusion. Spending increases dramatically when government revenue is high. Alaska is not unique. Elected officials of all political stripes have struggled throughout the country to control spending under years of surplus. While the legislature has made reductions to government spending since 2013, we would argue that it's fairly easy to make some cuts when the annual budget deficit is minus $3 billion. The challenge to keeping spending under control is when times are good. Alaskans and elected officials have recognized this dilemma in years past and sought to enact public policy reforms. As stated previously, the legislature passed an amendment to the state constitution that limited annual appropriations, and voters agreed, more than once, mind you, with Alaskans voting overwhelmingly to support the limitation. In fact, after initially passing in 1982, when given the option to overturn the limitation 4 years later, Alaskans supported the appropriation limit to the constitution 71% to 29%. More recently, in a poll commissioned by the Alaska State Chamber 2 years ago, over 53% of Alaskans supported a state spending cap, to 33% who did not. Anecdotally, We Americans for Prosperity have held state spending cap town halls in Kenai, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Palmer, and the support was overwhelming. The majority of Alaskans have not changed their opinion since the early 80s. They want a limit on state spending. And right now is the perfect time to enact a limit on appropriations because state spending has been declining for the last few years. We're in a valley instead of a peak in state spending. There are several examples of how to enact spending limits, but you don't need to look further than Anchorage for one example. The municipality of Anchorage has had a tax limit and a spending limit since 1983. Both the tax and spending limits adjust annually with changes in inflation. Both are effective at controlling the growth of government beyond the growth in the local economy, as long as politicians don't try to get around the caps. For instance, recently the Anchorage mayor and assembly found themselves in a position where they had $9 million in property taxes that couldn't be spent because they had reached the spending limit for the year. Instead of refunding the $9 million to Anchorage residents, our local elected officials suspended the spending cap for 2 years so they could spend that $9 million. Now compare that example to the state of Colorado, which has the gold standard in tax and spend limits known as TABOR. The Colorado Taxpayer Bill of Rights has been an effective brake on the growth of government as long as politicians haven't tried to get around it. Approved by voters in 1992, TABOR establishes limits on the amount of taxes that can be collected and a cap on the amount the government can spend. When the state takes in more than can be spent because of the spending cap, the excess is given back in the form of a sales tax refund or an earned income tax credit. Since implementation in 1992, $2 billion has been refunded to Colorado taxpayers. The lessons learned in Colorado and Anchorage can be applied to the state of Alaska. If the legislature enacts new taxes and or uses permanent fund earnings to pay the balance of the state budget deficit, there is no mechanism in place to protect Alaskans from future increases in government spending. An effective appropriation limit is what Alaskans need. An effective appropriation limit that actually works would also help restore trust in Juneau. If I can go back to the tax and spend limits in Anchorage, I'd like to draw out additional lessons learned. The most significant difference between the Anchorage tax cap and the Anchorage spending cap is that the tax cap exists in the city charter, while the spending cap is in municipal code. I draw the distinction between the two policies because the tax cap has endured since the early 1980s because our elected officials couldn't suspend the tax cap. They did find ways around the tax cap, however. Mayor Mark Begich and the Assembly pulled taxes collected from the Anchorage wastewater utility and electric utility outside the tax cap as a way to raise property tax revenue. But a ballot initiative brought by local community activists restored the original intent of the tax cap, and utility payments were brought back under the cap. Similarly, last year, Mayor Berkowitz and the Assembly passed an ordinance that changed how the tax cap was calculated. Historically, the tax cap for the following year was based off of the amount of taxes collected the previous year, plus inflation and population. The mayor and the assembly changed the tax cap to be based off of the amount of taxes that could have been collected, not was actually collected. Again, this attempt to get around the cap and raise property taxes was met with opposition from Anchorage voters. A ballot initiative that Americans for Prosperity started restored the original intent of the tax cap when it passed by 20 points, 60% to 40%. The overwhelming support to restore the cap and the traditional formula crossed party lines. This was a nonpartisan issue. The lessons learned that the legislature should take away are threefold. First, if politicians can suspend the cap so they can spend more money on their priorities, they will. Second, the language of the spending cap must be watertight, or future legislators will try to poke holes in it. Third, the majority of Alaskans are largely supportive on limits and keep government from growing excessively. Whether they be limits at the local level or state level does not matter. The support is there. This issue is a bipartisan solution. Fiscal conservatives would like to eliminate the peaks in government spending, while proponents of government spending would like to get rid of the valleys or cuts to government services. This is a similar situation that occurred in Congress back in 2011, where the Budget Control Act was implemented. Fiscal conservatives did not like the cuts in defense spending, while more liberal-minded folks didn't like the cuts to social services spending. In the end, it was a winning solution, and Americans agreed. In closing, I applaud your efforts, Mr. Chairman, and the work of this committee. What this committee and this body does today will impact Alaska's future for years to come. So let's get this right. Alaska's future depends on it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Price or members of the committee? Thank you. Seeing none, we're going to move on to Bob Williams with the American Legislative Exchange Council out of Gig Harbor, Washington. Mr. Williams, are you online?
Yes, I'm online.
Could you please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony?
I'm Bob Williams. I'm a senior fellow with the American Legislative Exchange Council. I'm also on their Board of Scholars. But primarily, I head up the State Budget Solutions, which is a project of the ALEC Center for State Fiscal Reform. And on State Budget Solutions, we focus on outcome-based budgeting and also on pension reform. I'm an accountant by trade. I used to work for the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, and later founded the Evergreen Food Foundation, which is a Washington State-based think tank. I served five terms in the Washington State Legislature, but that was a century ago, from 1978 to 88. And during that time, I worked on tax limits and also on spending limits. And I commend you, Mr. Chair, and your staff for the tremendous amount of work you've done on this constitutional amendment, which is a big improvement over the one before. The purpose of spending limits is to provide the fiscal discipline necessary during strong periods of revenue growth. As you mentioned, if you don't have a strong limit in there on revenue growth, you overextend the budget, and then that creates a structural deficit caused by the overspending. And also in the other key which you have in Alaska is also having a reserve. So the main benefits of what I see in this bill, it makes government more accountable. It forces discipline over budget and tax practices. It makes government more efficient. It makes government think of creative ways to generate revenues. It controls the growth of government. It forces government to evaluate programs and prioritize services. It raises questions about the advisability of some functions provided by government. It helps citizens feel empowered and result in more taxpayer satisfaction. And it helps diffuse the power of special interests. And I would agree with the AFP person that make sure it stays watertight. We've seen a lot of states that their spending limits, their TELs, are good for the first 2 years. And then they put in exceptions, like you can have fees or something to get around it, or other exceptions. The other thing I would add is, once you get this through, I would urge you to consider your budget reform, changing the budget process to an outcome performance-based budgeting. And ALEC has a lot of material in that area if you're interested in it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Any questions for Mr. Williams from members of the committee? Thank you. Question? Okay, thank you. So with that, we're going to lay the bill off to the side. Like I said, I believe personally this is probably
if not the most important piece of legislation, one of the most important pieces of legislation, and a tool that I think all Alaskans are going to be looking at as we move forward. We work for the people of Alaska. We have to remember that. And for decades, we were fortunate enough to have a large amount of oil revenue. And I think most of us agree now that that paradigm may have changed somewhat. And as we look into the future, I think we owe it to the people that we represent that before we make decisions on taxation or changes in the permanent fund or other revenue enhancements, that they have their say. They have the ability to tell us what are they looking at in terms of the size of government and whether they want to help us stay within some constraints. 82, they did it. 86, they did it. This is an opportunity to bring it back to them, to revise it, to deal with today's reality. So with that, are there any closing questions or remarks from the committee before we set this bill aside and then we're going to adjourn? Again, I want to thank the folks that worked on this, Ledge Finance, Ledge Legal, and others, and we will be tapping into your expertise as we go through this process to make this the best possible spending limit in the country. With that, we're going to lay it aside, and we're going to adjourn. Next meeting is on Thursday. I just want to double-check. And on Thursday, we'll be going back to the permanent fund bills, SB 21 and SB 26. We will continue our meetings, and we will have folks here for us to be able to ask questions and dive more into the mechanics of both of these bills. So that's SB 21 and SB 26. That will be Thursday, February 16th at 3:30 p.m. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you.